It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll take a look at President Obama's treatment of foreign policy and see if it's contributing to Americans' pessimism about the country's importance in the world.
First, it is freezing outside, literally. Temperatures around Wisconsin have plunged to lows that some cities haven't seen since the mid-90s. And the National Weather Service has referred to these temperatures as life-threatening.
Many kids are home from school today. A lot of schools are already closed for tomorrow as well. We're going to take a look at how Wisconsinites are facing the frigid weather around the state.
Joining us from Wausau, where temperatures reached the negative 20s this morning, is WPR reporter Glenn Moberg. We'll be joined later by a reporter in La Crosse, too. Thanks for joining us, Glenn.
Well, hi, Veronica. Hi, Rob.
So what is it looking like where you are in Wausau?
Well, right now it is 19 below zero in Wausau, a balmy 19 below. It was 25 below when I got into work this morning. The deck on the second floor of my house in Merrill read 27 below, and
wow.
We had an unofficial reading from one of my friends in Rhinelander of 32 below zero. So the schools are closed today. They'll be closed again in Wausau, and I haven't seen the schools in this community closed for two consecutive days, and it's getting on about 15 years now. So this is it's cold outside.
Now, I heard this morning that Wausau was the coldest spot in the state. Is that what you're hearing, too?
Well, we got a reading that was colder than that in Rhinelander, but I would say north-central Wisconsin is definitely the coldest region in the state.
Now, is the whole town shut down, shops and restaurants, or are people kind of going about their business as usual, just bundled up?
Well, people are tough up north, and a lot of businesses and restaurants and so on are open, but there aren't very many people inside those restaurants and stores, and not many people on the road.
I spotted a jogger this morning. Are you seeing any joggers up there?
No.
That's probably maybe for the best. It's awfully cold out. And I also know that you spoke with some of the city's homeless this morning. What's their situation?
You know, we're used to taking all of this in stride. For instance, the events leading up to the Packer 49ers game, it was almost a matter of civic pride that we could have the coldest football game in the nation. But it's no joke for the homeless. And I did stop in at Catholic Charities, which is a homeless shelter on the west side of Wausau that takes in about 20 people every night. And if they didn't have a facility like that, we'd have a lot of dead people in town. And that's really no joke. Talk to a volunteer who routinely passes out things like earmuffs and hats and hand warmers and toe warmers to the people under the bridges, and they are finding a warm place to stay at night, but the volunteers are not enough to take care of all the people who need the help, so they get shunted around in town between the Catholic Charity shelter, which is open at night, and then Salvation Army during the day. Talk to one a young man, 26 years old, who came here from Florida and ended up on the street. He's not used to 25 below zero, and he can't find work. And I think that's really the story in town. That and I ran into an elderly man in his 80s, said he was too embarrassed about his situation to let us use his last name, because here he should be enjoying his retirement, his golden years, and instead he finds that he has to stay in a homeless shelter. And it's sad. It's sad that in the richest country in the world, things like this happen, but they do. And thank God for the shelters, because it's keeping people alive tonight.
Yeah, we know Wisconsin can be a tough place, but you add, you know, temperatures like we're seeing, and you really do get situations that are life-threatening, and it sounds like bringing people to the sort of the brink of what they can endure.
Well, indeed, and frostbite is a real problem. With temperatures like this, skin can freeze, exposed skin, in less than a minute. And hypothermia, of course, is a problem. And it's keeping the people who run our emergency shelters preoccupied. I will mention that as cold as this is, it isn't as cold as I've seen it here. In February of 1996, and this is no lie, that the temperature reading outside my home in Merrill got down to 43 below zero, and that was air temperature.
43 below.
And I really doubt we'll ever see that again. I was thinking we might come close, but as cold as this is, it isn't as cold as some of the predictions had it being just a couple of days ago.
I walked out of my warm house this morning. Actually, the heater wasn't keeping up. It wasn't that warm. And I thought that it felt not too bad until I realized it was actually kind of hard to breathe. And I think I can't imagine what it would be at 43 below. It's intense stuff. Now, Glenn, you also reported on temperatures at the Packer game yesterday. What conditions did the fans and players face there?
They thought, I talked to a meteorologist, Tony Schumacher, who works at WAOW here in Wausau. He used to work in Green Bay, and he worked at Channel 7 in Wausau prior to that. And he thought it might get down as low as 8 below zero for the game itself, maybe even 10 below. And it was about 10 degrees warmer than that. We had, I think, starting temperatures at 5 above, and it might have gotten down as low as 0 degrees, which is still a problem if you're sitting in the stands watching a game for 2.5 hours. But not as bad as they thought it was, and it didn't come close to the legendary Ice Bowl back in the 60s when the thermometer reading actually got down to 13 below zero.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I guess we're lucky the game wasn't today. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for joining us and giving us the view from Wausau.
There you go. Glad to be here and glad I'm not outside.
All right. Stay warm. Glenn Moberg joining us from Wausau. And now let's hear from Maureen McCollum. She's a reporter in La Crosse. Hey, Maureen.
Hey, Veronica.
So what's the scene like in La Crosse? How's the city coping?
It is, at least when I was driving around downtown around the lunch hour, it was pretty slow down there. Kind of like what Glenn said, the restaurants seemed pretty slow. I did see a lot of delivery drivers on the streets, so hopefully people were tipping them nicely for not having to go outdoors. But, yeah, you know, the streets are empty. It seems like most people are going to work, but some places have given the option of being able to stay home.
Are you seeing things like tow trucks on the road, stalled out cars, or is it just kind of a ghost town?
Surprisingly not. I did not see a single stalled car and not many tow trucks out and about. So hopefully people are just being careful and following the warnings that the roads are pretty slick out there.
Now, Gwen had talked with some of the homeless in Wausau, and I'm wondering what options the homeless have in La Crosse in this weather.
It's interesting because actually La Crosse and Wausau are set up very similarly when it comes to options for homeless people. In La Crosse, we also have a Salvation Army, and Catholic Charities also runs a warming center here. At the Salvation Army, I talked with the major there earlier, and he said surprisingly they saw actually less people last night than they usually have. They still have, they're seeing a good amount of people today coming in for meals and whatnot, but he thinks part of the reason that they saw less people last night was because the city of La Crosse, as well as county officials and some area nonprofits, came together and decided to open up the convention center downtown, the La Crosse Center, and make that a warming center starting yesterday, and it'll go into Wednesday morning. This is the first time that they've done anything like this. I went down there to talk with some people, and they took a corner of the convention center, and people brought in hot soup and coffee. I know there are a lot of sandwiches that were donated. There were a handful of people there, about 6 or 7 people when I went. They had about 12 people stay there last night. But, you know, the people were talking about how they were just happy they had another option, somewhere to go. I talked with one man, his name is Chris, and he has a dog that he refuses to part with. And he says it's his best friend, and he puts his dog's need before his own. And they've been staying in their car for the last few months. But he said it's because he can't go to any of the shelters. So when they found out, because shelters don't allow pets, so when they found out that they could both go to the La Crosse Center, they were very happy.
Oh, really? So the La Crosse Convention Center is taking animals, pets?
Yes. Yeah, they say it's on a case-by-case basis. This dog was just the sweetest boxer you've ever met, just so friendly and lovable, greeted everyone that came into the room. So, you know, obviously, if it's a nice dog or a dog that's not going to be problematic for other people, I think it's okay.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. We don't often think about that. When people have to seek shelter, they can leave pets behind.
Right.
And we know we saw a lot of that in Katrina, but of course it's in play right now in Wisconsin, too. And what else are you expecting to see with the weather tomorrow? Are there plans for La Crosse in the next day or so?
I know. I have to check in with some of the school districts. I did hear from, we had one school call here, Bangor, said they're going to be starting 2 hours later. But it seems like maybe people have seen what today has brought. I'm sure people will still be seeking shelter, those who need it. But I kind of have a feeling for those who are fortunate to have shelter and have a car and a place to go at night, that they've just prepared well and will probably go on their daily business.
Now, cold weather like this, it can be difficult not just for people who are homeless, but for people who, you know, maybe can't afford the giant puffy parka and the sub-zero boots. Do you know how, you know, what kinds of other challenges people might be facing in this cold?
I know that at least here in La Crosse, efforts like coat drives that they have, there have been some good organization on that end when it comes to preparing to get people coats and mittens and hats. You know, they have all sorts of cold weather drives. And at least when I talked with the folks at the Salvation Army, they're not necessarily getting this surge in people who are asking for donations or asking for another coat right now. I think people have probably prepared a bit when it comes to that. But, you know, those who maybe didn't have the proper coats or mittens, maybe they're just indoors somewhere at the Salvation Army. A lot of people go to the library during the day, just waiting until they can get into the warming center. Or even the people at the La Crosse Center today, you know, there are a handful of people just sitting around reading books, talking with each other.
Maureen, thank you so much for talking with us today and for reporting on it, giving us a scene from La Crosse, and stay warm today.
Yeah, you too.
We've been talking to Maureen McCollum, WPR's reporter in La Crosse.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. According to a recent Pew survey on foreign policy, 70% of Americans think the country has lost respect in the world. And for the first time in the 40 years of the survey, more than half of Americans think the nation's importance in world affairs has gone down over the last decade.
And a lot of people are glad about that. The survey shows that over half of us think the U.S. should mind its own business internationally. Another first for that survey. Our guest says this pessimism and lack of support for international involvement results from a failure of leadership by President Obama. Lamont Colucci joins us now. He's associate professor of politics at Ripon College, author of The National Security Doctrines of the American Presidency. His column appears on the U.S. News and World Report website. Lamont, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, I don't want to put words in your mouth, a failure of leadership by the Obama administration, is that right?
Yeah, I think that the data that comes out of this report, and it's very exhaustive, and it goes into many, many different questions and many variables within variables, illustrates a steady decline and pessimism among the electorate concerning international affairs, foreign policy, and even national security. And so the question one has to ask is, you have to get beyond the data points. The data points can provide you some very interesting quantitative data, but then at the end of the day, you have to ask the question of why is that the case, and you start trying to connect the dots with this information, and it's this consistent inability of the administration to want to lead. There's a lot of reasons I think for that, but at the end of the day, it's a question of leadership and an unwillingness to go in front of these issues and be proactive and to have a broad grand strategy that goes beyond a month, a day, even a year.
Well, in that survey, and I wonder maybe in the White House as well, there's the concept of war fatigue. We got embroiled in Iraq for a long time, Afghanistan for a long time. People are asking, and maybe policy strategists are asking, do we want to take the lead in a place like Syria where we get sucked in and involved and stuck there for 5, 6, 7, 8 years?
Well, according to the report, 42% of Americans cited war fatigue as one of the great factors of how they're reacting to these different questions. And there's a couple of things with that. First of all, as I note in the article in U.S. News, prior to this, the media had been kind of making up the information by saying the majority or two-thirds of Americans had war fatigue. Now, 42% is not a small number, not the majority, It's not what I think the media wanted to put out there. Yes, I think there is an element of war fatigue, but then the question becomes, and that's where the problem is when you just take a look at these data points, why is there war fatigue? Is it simply because war has gone on for X number of years, or is it because the war and the various, I should say, the global war on terror, if you want to discuss separate possible war scenarios, that the explanation for these things and the reasons behind them were never put forth to the American electorate in a very solid and open way? I mean, it's one thing to say, are you war-weary about Afghanistan? And I would guess almost everybody would say yes. It's another thing to trace back, do people have an understanding of why we went into Afghanistan, why we went in the way we did, why we initially wanted to stay, what were the overall goals, and where do we want to see Afghanistan in 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
You're worried not just about pessimism, but a rise in isolationism, a new outbreak of isolationism when American people think of foreign policy. Why is that a worry for you?
Well, I think, there's a number of reasons. If you want to talk economics and business, it's clear, and the survey, I think one of the surprises that was found from the survey among many people is that in general, the vast majority of American people, the electorate, believe that global trade and trade in general is a good thing, and that this notion that perhaps there was this rising sentiment of protectionism and maybe desire for tariffs and to close off markets is false. So that's interesting unto of itself, and I think that has to be one reason you have to be very fearful, because when you look at the Depression, the Great Depression, and you look at all the things that made that initial economic collapse worse, it was the tariff structure. It was the Smoot-Hawley tariff bill. And so there is that issue on that economic, business, and jobs front, which, of course, is going to be a big concern of people all the time. On the national security front, the problem with the rising isolationism is that almost all of our problems and threats are not going to be able to be dealt with at home. That's especially true, I think, if you look at the issue of terrorism. There's so much focus on the TSA at airports or at harbors, or whatever the case may be, and all of that's very important. But at the end of the day, if you really want a strategic policy against terrorism, counterterrorism, it's going to be something that's going to take place abroad. And whether we're talking about the desire to deter war, whether it's the desire to avoid war, whether it's the desire to ensure American security and stability and prosperity, these things will all happen by actions abroad in foreign policy and international affairs.
Those are some practical outcomes you're looking for in national security policy. How about what's been called the idealist view that we should be promoting democracy around the world? Does the United States have a role to play? Are we fulfilling that role?
Well, I think that was probably the most disappointing aspect of the report, in my opinion. It shows that 18%, only 18% of Americans view democracy promotion as a top priority, down from a high of 29% in, I think, the early part of the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, where they made that a priority. And I think that probably illustrates exactly my point and why I wrote the article in U.S. News, in that the inability of the administration to make it a priority, but not just to make it a priority, but to explain what do we really mean by democracy promotion. We don't mean having a single election, one man, one vote, one time. It doesn't mean even elections in general. Democracy promotion was, is, and always has been a whole concept where you're talking about civil society and constitutional protections within their culture and their history, a system of laws and elections, the guarantee of rights, minority protection, and all of those things we in many ways take for granted in the United States under the Constitution. It definitely doesn't just mean an election. I think that's where everything went off the rails, because people saw, well, this country had, in the Arab Spring, an election, look what kind of regime was elected, look at this chaos. And they said, if that's democracy promotion, I don't want any part of it, and I don't want our sons and daughters dying for that. And of course that makes sense if that's how it's explained.
In our last minute, do you see any likelihood of change in the last 2 years of the Obama administration?
I'm not sure if I see change with the Obama administration, because if, you know, when I look at all the different possible scenarios, be it Iraq, especially Iraq, what we're hearing about today in Anbar province, Syria, Libya, Iran, North Korea, South Sudan. I don't see them having this realization that there has to be a grand strategic view that takes the United States well into 5 or 10 years in the future. Of course, we all hope that that would be the case. But I'm not sure the administration, it's so focused on domestic affairs and domestic issues and domestic controversy. In many ways, I think they believe foreign policy is a distraction.
Lamont, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was Lamont Colucci. He's associate professor of politics at Ripon College, author of The National Security Doctrines of the American Presidency.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the American job market is becoming increasingly polarized, according to our guest. He says more and more people are caught in low-income service jobs with little hope of better pay.
We'll find out about the damaging impact of sleep deprivation and how it can affect us in our daily lives.
And a philosopher will share the lessons he's learned about life, love, and death from his daily runs with his pack of dogs.
That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.
Still to come, today on Central Time, our guest will share hidden treasures of the regional food world in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Minnesota. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up after 4, tips on keeping our New Year's resolutions by tricking ourselves.
First, our next guest explores the hidden treasures of the food world in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and beyond. He says great food doesn't need to be fancy, faddish, or far away.
James Norton is a food writer, editor of HeavyTable.com, and editor of the new book, The Secret Atlas of North Coast Food. He joins us now from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio. James, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So before we get to the food, so let's tackle this term North Coast. What is the North Coast?
Well, it's half in jest, but half serious. I've got a lot of friends on the East Coast and a lot of friends on the West Coast, and you get the sense that things are going on the coast. They're very cosmopolitan. They're open to the world. And here we are in Minnesota and Wisconsin with access to the Great Lakes, which I think really opens us up to the world, and the Mississippi River as well. And if you hang out in Madison and Milwaukee and St. Paul and Minneapolis, they're very vibrant cities. You know, I don't miss Boston. I don't miss New York. I love being here. So North Coast is a term worth throwing around to sort of say, by the way, there's stuff going on in the middle of the country, too.
And the East Coast is known for the food, the West Coast known for the food. Does the North Coast stack up?
I think at this point, we still have some catching up to do. The really exciting thing is that we're doing it. I think there's really a food revolution going on in the upper Midwest. And really what it's all about is connecting our restaurants and our home kitchens and our day-to-day eating to the farms and the breweries and the distilleries and the bakeries and chocolatiers all around us. It's about connecting to where we are. I think there's been a long time sort of idea that if your restaurant's really good, you're aspiring to be Parisian, you know, you're aspiring to be in Tokyo, and people are waking up and saying, wait a second, there's fantastic meat here, there's fantastic poultry, there's world-class cheese, there's terrific beer, you know, let's embrace the stuff from right around the corner and celebrate that. And that, I think, is when your cuisine becomes an authentic cuisine and it can take its place among the great cuisines of the world. And that's what we're working on right now.
So you're out to celebrate North Coast cuisine. What are the bright spots? What do we really have to feel proud about?
I think we've got quite a bit. And the chapter that I actually wound up writing was about cheese and cheesemakers. And the cheese scene, particularly in Wisconsin, but increasingly also in Minnesota, is just so absolutely exciting. There's this amazing depth of knowledge and expertise going back 3, 4, 5, even 6 generations, you know, from German and Swiss immigrants who made farmstead cheese way back in the mid-19th century to the current day. I think for quite a while, particularly the 70s, the 80s, early 90s, Wisconsin cheese was commodity cheese. You're just making giant bricks of Colby or Kojak or cheddar or Swiss. And all that artisan knowledge was still there, but it wasn't really being taken advantage of. And as milk prices gyrated all over the place, cheesemakers began looking for a better way. And they started discovering there's a lot of value that can be added by making specialty cheeses, by making artisan cheeses. And we've just seen this revolution, this blossoming in the amount of cheese available, the different varieties available, the skill with which it's made. There's just really exciting new cheeses popping up, I would say, every year around here. And if you look at the medals that particularly Wisconsin wins in national and international competitions, you know, it can stand shoulder to shoulder with, you know, Italy, with France. It's absolutely fantastic.
And part of what's driving that, as you write in your chapter on cheese, is the personality of the people behind it. Can you introduce us to a couple of the cheesemakers you detail in the book?
Yeah, I actually wrote another book called The Master Cheesemakers of Wisconsin, and that's when I discovered that cheesemakers are kind of my favorite people in the world. But a couple that really inspired me, there's this guy named Michael Stenitis, and he's up near Cornucopia, sort of the Ashland Bayfield, Madeline Island part of the state. And he is a goat cheesemaker, and he lives basically out in the woods with his herd of goats. And every evening he goes and mixes himself a gin and tonic or a cosmopolitan, and he takes his goats on a walk through the woods so they can kind of eat all the various plants and forage as they go. And, you know, then he turns their milk into cheese. And I think that's just it's a fantastic story. It's a very old story. I'm sure people were, minus the gin and tonic, people were doing this 2,000 years ago. And he's kind of bringing us back to that. There's also some really cool innovators. Sid Cook of Carr Valley Cheese is just this sort of mad scientist character. He's always trying really inventive mixed milk cheeses and rubbed cheeses and different kinds of aging processes. He'll tell you he'll take one vat of milk and he can turn it to eight different cheeses depending on how he, you know, ages it out and otherwise handles it. It's just, you know, a really inspiring level of innovation and play and creativity taking place.
I love the beginning of your essay on cheese where you get kind of mystical about it and you say that cheese is actually alive.
Well, it really is actually alive. I think a lot of the really great foodstuffs in the world, like wine, like beer, to some extent, it changes as it ages. It changes before it gets to you. If you keep it in the fridge or keep it in the cellar, it can get better. It can get worse. It can get more complicated. And that's just like a really fascinating aspect of cheese is you've got these living microorganisms that are playing such an important role. And there's this idea of terroir, the taste of the land, the taste of where you are. And I think that can be, you know, more or less bunk. But when it comes to cheese, I think there's really something to it because what the animals are eating and the way those sort of micro fauna play on the cheese is really an important factor in the way it comes out. And sometimes you cannot make a cheese in one place that you can make somewhere else. It's not necessarily a portable art form. Where you are always kind of transforms the product.
A lot of your book covers the hidden treasures of the restaurant world in our states. What makes a great North Coast restaurant for you?
Well, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it because I like to eat a lot of different things. One of my favorite chapters in the book was a diner's survey of South Park Street in Madison by John Kovalik. And he found some, you know, restaurants you maybe have never heard of right here in Madison. There's a place called Ichiban. Now, Ichiban is not serving, you know, farm-to-table food. It's not local cheese. It's not any of the stuff I've been talking about and raving up. There's only two kinds of beer, and I think they're both kind of watery. But what it is this really amazing Szechuan and Hunan dishes. They're not dumbed down. They're incredibly vibrant and challenging, and you get the Szechuan peppercorns just like numbing and exciting your mouth, and you know, just the heat from the food as well, kind of overwhelmingly, all these bright, aggressive, beautiful flavors. And that's really neat, finding those little pockets of authenticity. And whether that's, you know, a farm fresh ham and Swiss sandwich or whether it's authentic Szechuan cuisine on South Park Street, you know, I think what I'm looking for in a great restaurant is just someone who cares about what they're doing, who really is interested in the flavor balance and does their best to get the best ingredients. And what's neat is that can happen anywhere. It can happen in a diner. It can happen in a four-star restaurant. It can happen in a little hole in the wall somewhere. You just have to keep your sort of your eyes and your palate tuned in for it.
Well, if we're over in your neck of the woods, if we're in the Twin Cities, what is a place that you think we should check out to kind of get the real taste of the North Coast?
There's a number of them. Wow. My mind just hit a wall there. but I'm going to give you my easy answer. There's a place called Corner Table in South Minneapolis. And the chef there is Thomas Bamer. The owner's Nick Rancone. And they just care so much. They really source their products locally and seasonally. And they take apart an entire pig and work with all the different parts of it, or an entire lamb. And so the specials are always really remarkable. They've got rabbit coming through there that's just fantastic. It's probably at this point the only place I'll order pork belly, because I know they will always do it perfectly. Thomas Bamer's got this low country Carolinas cooking background, and he kind of brings that with him. And their treatment of pork is just, it's mystical. It's amazing. It is something to be seen. So a Corner Table is a great place. It's not pretentious. It's not stuffy. It's a little joint, but they really are in tune, I think, with the farmers and with the ranchers and with the flow of the seasons, and that's really important.
Reading through your collection, it seems like anywhere we go in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and beyond, there's probably some awesome food that we don't know about. When you were pulling this together, did you just get the sense like every time you looked in an area, a city or even a rural area, you were finding something awesome?
Yeah. I mean, what's really both kind of irritating and interesting about the way we travel is when we go from city to city, we get on the interstate and we just drive as fast as we can to wherever we're going. And if we're going to eat, we just pull off and, you know, we hit Culver's in a best case scenario and then we keep going. And one of the things we did in this book is we took a number of little road trips, which means you get off the interstate. Maybe you actually go into the center of these little towns, you know, in Wisconsin and Iowa and Minnesota, and you see where the locals are eating. And sometimes it's a really great diner. Sometimes it's a supper club. Sometimes it's, for whatever reason, it's a Greek restaurant. It's an Italian restaurant where people have been doing things with some care for years and years. The book's origins are with Kickstarter, which is a crowdfunding website where lots of people can kind of contribute money to get a big project off the ground. And anyone who gave us $100 or more on Kickstarter, we said, why don't you contribute your hidden gem? Tell us about a little restaurant somewhere that's exciting to you, that means something to you. So we actually have a crowdsourced chapter, which is really fun. You can read 20 or so little nuggets from the people who contributed to make the book possible. And there's some really cool places, really far off the beaten path in some cases.
James Norton is with us. He's the editor of the new book, The Secret Atlas of North Coast Food.
And you can join in. Do you have a hidden treasure to share, a great restaurant or a food producer, a farmer's market in your part of Wisconsin or one of our neighbors? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. What's your hidden gem? 1-800-642-1234, or send us email at talk@wpr.org.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation about the hidden treasures of the food world in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and beyond with James Norton. He's editor of The Secret Atlas of North Coast Food.
And you can join in. What do you think makes for a great restaurant? Do you have a hidden gem in your part of the state? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We've got a hidden gem now from John in Richland Center. John, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, my hidden gem is Karen Supper Club in Boaz, Wisconsin. It's 8 miles west of Richland Center, right off of Highway 14, and then 171 south, about a mile.
And what makes it a gem?
Oh, she makes the best prime rib and ribeye steaks and excellent salad bar. There's like 12 things on the salad bar.
John, thanks so much for sharing that. Karen's Supper Club in Boaz, Wisconsin. And James, are there a lot of restaurants like that where people say maybe it's not everything on the menu, but they have the best blank?
Absolutely. I mean, prime rib certainly comes up more than once. And you hear about the old fashioned, of course, with brandy, naturally, in a number of different places. I think one of the mistakes I find with new restaurants opening up, actually, I just went to a place a few days ago that had this problem. They try to be everything at once. They try to be Asian fusion and small plates and steaks, and just they kind of keep throwing things at you. I think a good restaurant is comfortable in its own skin and knows what it's doing. And that's one of the beautiful things about some of these old supper clubs is they've got sort of a limited menu. Everyone knows the focus. They know what they're going to get. There's probably going to be pudding in the salad bar for some reason. And that's okay. I think that's great. I think it's great to have a sharp identity to what you're doing and be comfortable with who you are and what you're doing.
You're saying pudding's not a salad? Come on.
Yeah, I don't know. There are some mysterious things going on. I don't know if you've ever had Snickers salad or fudge stripe cookie salad. If you start going into the Dakotas, weird things start happening with the word salad. That's another thing we kind of uncovered in our research.
We have a Facebook comment from Shahira who's wondering if vegetarian and vegan restaurants are on the rise in the North Coast.
I think absolutely. And more importantly than that, I think, is an awareness of or sensitivity to vegetarian and vegan eating. So I think a lot more places will be conscious of having some options that fit those criteria, and not just out of a sense of obligation, not just a veggie burger, but something really actually very delicious and well-crafted. And I think a good chef is always trying to think about everyone who's going to come through the door and how to make them feel welcome, how to make them feel happy. And that's more and more a part of the conversation.
We'll go back to our callers now. We have Lucas in Sherburn, Minnesota. Lucas, hi.
Hi.
What's your recommendation?
I'm bringing my hidden gem from Minnesota, right off of I-90, in a place called Sherburn, not in Sherburn County, but in Martin County. And they did an interesting thing where our local cafe called the Cup and Saucer was out of business, and so they wanted to innovate, and they opened it up to an essay contest for gourmet chefs from Minnesota to apply and see what they could do to renovate this little cafe that's basically a gas station shop for most people in southern Minnesota. And they overhauled the cafe, and they are serving up really fantastic cuisine there now in the prairie land there where I grew up.
All right. Thanks a lot for that, Lucas. And that's kind of innovative, James, an essay contest to see who can reopen the old cafe.
Yeah, it's cool. I mean, and I think what that has in common with a lot of other projects I've seen is this sense of community. You know, I talked about how Kickstarter essentially made this book possible as a community of people who were interested in the topic, all kind of banding together. More and more small independent places I see starting up will use Kickstarter or Indiegogo, other platforms like that, not just to raise money, but also to raise awareness of what they're doing, to get feedback and buy-in, to market before they open their doors. And I think it's really smart. I think you wind up opening smarter and better, and with a crowd of people already kind of behind you. And I can see parallels with this essay contest idea.
James, I want to go back to something you said earlier. You said you didn't think we were quite on par with the coast yet, the East and West Coast, in terms of food. What do we need to do to get there, do you think?
Well, I mean, I should say, I lived in Boston for about 5 or 6 years, and at this point, I would rather eat in the Twin Cities than Boston. So, I don't think we're miles and miles away. One of the things that's challenging is density. When I lived in New York, you know, you've got so many people stacked so tightly. You can have a restaurant that just does rice pudding, and it can do okay because you've got such a thick mass of people that are really specialized, really passionate about one thing kind of place can make it. And that I think we're always going to kind of struggle with that. I think our killer edge is just so much good food is grown and raised here, and we're going to catch up and or exceed what you can get on the coasts. Granting California their amazing fruit and vegetables, which I'm always a little jealous of, I think we're going to catch up on that basis, also on the basis of the terrific cheese and the terrific beer and some of the terrific fish. If you go up on the North Shore, South Shore, Lake Superior, and you get local herring or whitefish, oh my goodness, that can be just a world-class experience.
We have another recommendation for a culinary hidden gem. We have Arthur in Hub City. Arthur, hi.
Good afternoon. You guys are having a great program, and I certainly enjoy your points of view.
Thanks.
My hidden gem is a little restaurant in a town called Reedstown. It's halfway between Madison and La Crosse. And on Friday nights, they do a poor man's lobster, which is really a fancy way of saying cooking cod without the batter. And it is out of this world good.
What's that restaurant?
Kickapoo Inn.
The Kickapoo Inn in Reedstown. All right. Thanks a lot for that recommendation, Arthur. I don't know if you hit it in the book, but fish fry. Where do you go to find good fish fry?
You know, I think that is the sort of question that you have to look within your own soul and your own family tree to find the answer to. There's so many out there, and it's so I think so dependent on what part of the state you're in. I think you really have to look for it. I've had good ones all over the place though in Wisconsin. It's one of the real joys about the state. In Minnesota, you really only get fish fries during Lent. You've got this crazy season of fish fry, and then it kind of goes away again. So you guys don't know how good you've got it.
Well, I think we should talk a little bit about wine, which is not something you necessarily associate with Wisconsin, but I guess there are starting to be more and more wineries in Wisconsin and Minnesota and Iowa. Tell us what we're seeing here in the wine scene.
Well, we have a chapter in the book called The Curious History of North Coast Wine by John Garland. And John Garland's a really interesting guy. He actually is a judge for the Cold Climate Wine Competition here at the University of Minnesota. So he knows his stuff. He really dug into the research. And the chapter is mostly an examination of all the different things that have gone wrong with trying to do wine in the Midwest, and how just in the last 20 or 30 years, we're getting more and more skillful with sort of cold weather hardy varietals. So we can make wine from our own grapes and kind of catch up with the rest of the world. And I think there's some real promise, particularly for some of the sort of Riesling or ice wine style wines for our region to catch up. That said, I feel like we should put our chips on beer and just go for broke, because that's the culture, that's the history. But if you really want to dig into, you know, why wine works or doesn't work up here, the Secret Alice of North Coast Food has got just a really fascinating deep dive read about that.
But California is not exactly looking over its shoulder on that one.
No, and nor should they be. that I think they can. I think they can be pompous about that. No one should blame them.
What other bright spots do you see in the North Coast, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa? Emerging trends, maybe, when it comes to food.
Well, I love ethnic food, and I am surprised at how often, sometimes in very small towns or strip malls, I will find authentic, just absolutely fantastic, particularly Mexican food. In the Twin Cities, there's a great deal of Southeast Asian, particularly Vietnamese and Hmong food that is just terrific. And again, John Kovalik's chapter in the book about restaurants on South Park Street, a lot of it is just this connection with first-generation eating traditions popping up in small, unexpected places. And you don't necessarily think of it as Midwestern food, but it's really such a lovely, vital part of the scene that it's worth seeking out.
Now, part of the reason that the food of the North Coast shines is the localism movement, the farm-to-table movement. Is there any danger of that petering out and us losing some of our steam, or is this something that's just going to keep going and making us stronger?
It's just going to keep going and making us stronger. I'm not worried at all. I think if you go to France or you go to Italy, one of the reasons why the food is so phenomenal is because people have had 1,000 years, 1,500 years to figure out what their region just does brilliantly and really focus on it, really showcase it in a wonderful way. And we're such a younger country and younger place that we're still sort of stumbling toward, well, what do we do well? What is local? What can we raise that tastes fantastic? And I think the farm-to-table movement is trying to answer that question. It's in the process of answering it. And we're just going to get – I think we're going to get better and better and stronger on that front. I don't think it's a fad. I don't think it's going anywhere. I think it's absolutely wonderful, and it's here to stay.
James, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was James Norton. He's editor of HeavyTable.com. His new book, also as editor, is The Secret Atlas of North Coast Food.
Coming up, if you've kept your New Year's resolution so far, well done. Our next guest has advice for keeping it going, though, for the next 359 days. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.